Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. It's April 9, 2013, and what is going on here in New York City? I cannot believe it. 80-degree weather in April. We've had all kinds of cold weather, and then just like that, it's warm. And I know it's a cliche to talk about the weather, but maybe that's one of the things that we like here in New York. We never know what to expect next, but it is a beautiful day. And if you have an opportunity, wherever you are, get outside. It's so good for us. Okay, well, let's get on to the program. Really interesting subject coming up. We're going to be talking about a book called Veganissimo, A to Z, with my guest, one of the co-authors, Reuben Proctor. He has been vegan since 2000 and has done translation, consulting, and administrative work for vegan companies and animal rights organizations since 2004. He was born in New Zealand and now lives and works in Germany. Welcome, bienvenue, and all that stuff to It's All About Food. Reuben, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Okay, it's late where you are, right?
Well, yes, it's 10 in the evening, so it's tolerable.
Okay, good. How's the weather over where you are?
Dismal.
Dismal. What part of Germany are you in?
In the southwest. It's south of Frankfurt.
Okay. Well, I do not... Maybe you can help me understand, but this is a little book, but it's loaded with information, and it's called Veganissimo, A to Z, a comprehensive guide to identifying and avoiding ingredients of animal origin in everyday products. And my first question is, how did you compile this book? I mean, I understand there was an original version 17 years ago, but there's a lot of stuff that goes into all of this.
Well, yes, basically it boils down to elbow grease, an awful lot of work.
Vegetable elbow grease, of course.
Of course, yes. basically it's just a lot of researching and compiling. I started compiling the original version about 2007, just getting the old information together and using that as a starting base for the rest of the research, and I spent the next 3 or 4 years just researching print, media, internet, whatever I could find, just filling in the gaps and getting as much information on ingredients and consumer goods as I could find.
Well, we live in a very complicated world today, and I always encourage people to read ingredients, and it's challenging. Often the ingredients on food, very small print. And then there are other products that don't even list what they're made of, which makes it extra challenging.
True.
You know, we used to have an expression, is it animal, vegetable, or mineral? And that described everything on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a list, and we're kind of breaking things down a little bit more these days because we know a little bit more. There's not just animal, vegetable, and mineral, but there's synthetic and microbiological.
Yes, that's right.
So let's, you know, I remember buying a laundry detergent recently, and it said it was 95% plant-based, and I panicked because I thought it was a vegan product, and it was a vegan product. I just didn't realize that the other 5% they must have been referring to was not animal, vegetable, or mineral. It was synthetic.
Yes, it would have been petroleum-based.
There you go, petroleum-based. So are all synthetic products are petroleum based?
Well, synthetic is sort of a different definition. It depends on how you define it. In terms of the book, we've sort of slightly simplified it to say synthetic is petroleum based, but basically synthetic is anything which was made in a laboratory.
Right. Now, something that's made in a laboratory, I like the way you say it, laboratory, is the maybe synthetic, but can some of the original ingredients that were used to make it come from animal or vegetable sources?
Oh, yes, definitely. Things like fatty acids, for instance, surfactants used in cleaning agents, or in fabric softeners, they tend to be synthetic, but they can also include fatty acids as just part of the chemical compound, and the fatty acids have to come from somewhere. And they could be from corn oil or soy oil or whatever plant oils, but they could just as easily be from animal body fat.
Right, so that makes it even more difficult to figure out where things come from when there are several layers or levels from where ingredients are originally derived from.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the process is used.
Sometimes I think manufacturers, you might call them to find out where their products are from, and they don't even know the original source of some of the ingredients they use.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I suppose. I mean, normally they should have specifications from their suppliers, but I mean, we're talking about supply chains with a whole lot of links and a global industrial complex. So, yes, it can be very difficult. It depends on how interested the companies are in actually stating where their raw materials come from and whether or not they, for instance, find it important to state whether something is vegetarian, vegan, GMO-free, or whatever.
Now, did you talk to any companies in putting together this book to find out about ingredients?
I tried to contact a couple, but they're very reticent about giving information. So basically what I relied on is the information that is in the public domain, which I can rely on. I did write to a couple of major companies, and basically you get virtually no replies. So I resorted to using reference works, encyclopedias, internet, just all the information that's in the public domain and which can be verified.
Right. I imagine all of that can be very, very challenging because most companies either are not set up to answer those kind of questions or they don't care.
I think probably it's more they don't care, although I think that may be changing because, I mean, consumer pressure is starting to gain a new dimension now in the 21st century. There are companies that are realizing that they can't necessarily afford to just sort of sit things out. I mean, these major companies have such resources that, I mean, without naming any names, multinational concerns are quite easily able to, you know, mobilize 100 lawyers to go and sue someone. So, I mean, public relations shouldn't be a problem. I think it's a combination of just not wanting to give them information, not wanting to let people know how things are made, protect their intellectual property perhaps. And, yeah, as I said, some of them probably won't even care.
Right. Well, obviously, one thing that's going to make them care is when the consumers are demanding it, demanding to know, and that's part of our job.
Exactly. And I think, well, just taking veganism as an example, it's growing, it's really burgeoning, and I'm not quite sure what it's like in the States, but it's certainly in Europe. You can notice the difference. When you go shopping, you're seeing more and more products labeled as vegan or vegetarian. So producers are realizing there is an increasing demand out there.
Yeah, that's really, really encouraging. I think you're doing a little better in Europe than we are here in the United States with a number of different kinds of food-related regulations like genetically modified foods and animal testing.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, just taking animal testing as an example, it's now completely banned for cosmetics in the European Union since March. So it's still allowed in some chemicals which may not be used exclusively for cosmetics, but also for, say, cleaning agents. So animal testing cosmetics is completely banned in the EU. GMO in foods have to be labelled, and consumers just don't want it. So basically, by default, there are no GM foods in Europe. People just don't buy it.
Now, the animal testing, this went into effect recently?
Yes, in March.
That's like less than a month ago.
Exactly. So it had been planned for a long time. EU law had been put into force, and they had a transition period, and there was some debate about extending the transition period to help the producers, well, whatever, find find new replacement methods or not have to change their production methods so quickly, but there was quite a lot of consumer complaint about that, so they stuck to it, and so the band's now complete.
That's really exciting. Now, I remember, there's one company, L'Oreal, that they were like one of the last companies that didn't want to give up testing, but obviously they had to.
Well, yes, at least in Europe.
In Europe. Now, can Europe consumers buy products from the United States that have been tested on animals?
No, because then the ban is on production and on sales. Mm. So it doesn't matter where it's not allowed to be produced in the EU, and even if it's not produced in the EU, it's not allowed to be sold if any animal testing is taking place.
That's very exciting. Now, of course, what many people confuse is animal testing with animal ingredients. So a product may say that it has not been tested on animals, but it could have killed animals products in it.
Well, exactly. I mean, cosmetics, once again, a major group of ingredients are the fatty acids and their derivatives. And fatty acids can be from any fats. So, shampoos, for instance, hair mousse can have chitin from, from crustaceans, from their shells. So even if it's not tested on animals, there'll be bits and pieces of animals in there, there may be. And if it's not stated that it's vegan or vegetarian, who knows?
Right. All right, let's jump into some of the ingredients. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of ingredients in the book, but there are so many things that we take for granted. I mean, we don't even think about what might be derived from animals, like heparin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered this after the fact. So you go into a hospital for an emergency procedure or some serious procedure, and you find out after the fact, or maybe never, or maybe before something, that your life has been saved or the treatment was enabled because of some products that came from animals, like heparin.
Yeah, exactly. It's obtained from the intestines of pigs, mostly.
I'm just changing here. I had gone in for some really bad surgery years ago, and I was shocked because as a vegan, I didn't want to use animal products. And then I discovered, even down to when my lips were dry and the nurse would apply a little a lip balm on it, and it had mm-hmm. lanolin in it.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, lip balm is not necessarily something that's life-saving. It's a matter of comfort, I suppose. But,
right.
The heparin is definitely a matter of, can be a matter of life and death. If you don't have an anticoagulant, you could get a life-threatening clot. I was faced with the same situation last year. I had to go in for major surgery. And I did some research, and I actually found there is a synthetic anticoagulant which can be used. Just one drawback, if you actually, I had to have a spinal drip, and the risk of getting, a dangerous bleed in that case is higher. So I still had to opt for the heparin from animals for a few days. And once they'd removed the drip, I was able to go to the synthetic anticoagulant, but at least there is that possibility now. It's a fairly new drug. And so there are developments which are, more pleasing.
So are you okay now? Was the surgery okay?
That was over a year ago, so I bounced back.
Good. Glad to hear that. And then there was a study that just came out. I don't know if you heard about it, but I'm really excited, and it was about carnitine.
Mm-hmm. It may not be as good as it's made out to be.
That's right. And I mean, I'm thrilled to hear about it. But carnitine is an ingredient that we can get from animal sources and in much smaller amounts from vegetable sources. And mm-hmm. It's primarily from red meat. That's probably where the name came from, carnitine.
Exactly.
And some doctors at the Cleveland Clinic just came out with this great study showing that there's some sort of bacteria in our gut that works with the carnitine and creates this arteriosclerosis buildup, and you have more of this certain bacteria in your gut if you're a meat eater.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed that eating meat, it was just another way to show how eating red meat contributed to heart disease and arteriosclerosis, and I was really excited to hear that. And then I went to your little book, and I read about carnitine.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is in here.
Yes, it is.
But there are so many different ingredients to just, you can't possibly keep track. Now, how did you know this particular book I'm looking at is for the United States, and you talk about regulations here in the United States. Did you find out what's going on here from the Internet?
Yes, basically. I mean, the FDA, for instance, has a lot of information. They have all the regulations online. So I was able to refer to those and, you know, plow my way through all the legalese. And I did the same for the Canadian version as well. And in terms of question where I just recognized, okay, it would be nice to have someone on the ground just get the right slant on it. We then got someone in the States to answer a couple of open questions. But in terms of regulations, it's all on the net. And as long as you know the sources you're referring to are reliable, such as, for instance, USDA or FDA, well, then you can put it in the book.
Oh, that sounds pretty good. The thing is, it's nice to have it all in one book because it was probably difficult to find all of this information.
Yeah, it was. It took quite a lot of checking and rechecking, and it took a while just to get into the swing of the way United States regulations work, because they use a different language to European language. So even if I'm reading an English European piece of legislation, it does have different wording, for instance, to an American law or regulation. So I had to get past that first of all, but yeah, once I got there and it was knee deep in the clauses, I was able to make sense of it.
How did you come up with the name Veganissimo? What was the origin of that?
Well, issimo is basically Italian for very or most. So, you know, in music you talk about pianissimo for very quiet or most quiet, or fortissimo for very loud. And in Europe, in Germany also, not just in Italy, this fragment issimo is often used as an intensifier. It's well known outside the Italian language area. And Lars Thomsen, whose idea the whole veganissimo thing was, he coined the phrase back in the mid-90s, and he brought out a set of three booklets, Veganissimo 1, 2, and 3, and 1 was the predecessor to this new book, Veganissimo A to Z, and 2 was a manual of animal rights, and 3 was a bibliography of animal rights. And so he coined the phrase back then, basically, because so many people know what issimo means over here,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't need quite as much explanation as it probably does in North America.
I like it. It sounds happy.
Yeah, some people take it too seriously and think that we're pitching it to the, you know, to the dour, humorless 150% vegans who, you know, the vegan police, so called. But it's not that at all. It's supposed to be fun. I mean, taking it seriously, but not getting too wrought up about it. I mean, do what you can, veganissimo, in the sense of, you know, doing the very best that you can. So yeah. And if someone finds it a fun term, then that's good.
Now, let's move to house cleaning products. In my house, I pretty much clean with baking soda and water, and I don't get into any other sophisticated formulations. But there are a lot of cleaning products out there. And after looking at your book, my understanding is the manufacturers don't even have to let us know what's in these products.
No. In fact, the labeling requirements in the United States are laxer than they are in Europe, but there is a voluntary agreement of North American producers, so that covers both the United States and Canada, and they tend to label their products as one would label a cosmetic product. So that basically means declaration of all the ingredients, or almost all. There are some that are allowed to be declared in a generic sense. So this is it's a voluntary scheme, but it's one that's increasingly being used by North American producers because they do realize that consumers don't like it if they're not being told anything.
Now, what about genetically modified organisms? It sounds like there are some that are being created to take the place of some animal products.
Well, yes, a good example would be insulin. Insulin traditionally was derived from the pancreas of cattle or pigs, and that was what was used for a few decades. But now they're able to get it from bacteria. So I personally would say rather that than killing animals, I would not go so far as to condone genetic engineering of anything larger than unicellular organisms, so only yeasts or bacteria. I think that's okay if it stops animals being killed. As I said, insulin is one very good example. The human insulin, it's been engineered to be as close to the insulin that we produce in our own bodies, because there was something of a problem with the porcine or bovine insulin, and that it tended to act more quickly and drop off more quickly than the human insulin, and some people also abreacted to it. We even had allergic reactions to it. So,
well, the best thing is to not need it.
Of course. I mean, yes, a vegan diet would go a long way to doing that.
Absolutely.
But, of course, I mean, there are people, for instance, you know, juvenile diabetes. There may be some possibilities to influence whether someone gets it or not, but there are too many factors in there. It may be genetic, it may be virus diseases involved. So
right.
I think there is still some scope for, you know, diabetic medication.
Right. Yes. Now, what's your story? You became a vegan in 2000.
Yes, early 2000. I'm actually not quite sure whether it's late 1999 or early 2000, but roundabout. I didn't have a Damascene moment. There wasn't sort of any situation where it was a click. It was a process. I went vegetarian in 1997, and in the course of time, I realized that it just wasn't enough. And so, yeah, early 2000, roughly, is when I took the leap and went vegan.
And were you in New Zealand or Germany at the time?
Germany.
Okay, so you haven't been in New Zealand for a long time.
Intermittently, just for short periods. But I've lived in Germany for the past, oh, good grief, over 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Germans are really good at making things clear and spelling things out and following guidelines. And so I find that when I go to Germany, it's pretty easy to find products that I know what I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, are some countries better than other countries, like models?
Hard to say. In Europe, European legislation is basically overrides anything else. So there aren't that many differences between France and Germany and the UK. I mean, it's all fairly uniform throughout the EU. I believe Australia, New Zealand, the EU and the United States are more or less on par. Although in the United States, I think the number of things that are allowed without having to be specified, the number of exceptions that are possible, I think are greater. So I think in the EU it'll be easiest, followed by Australia, New Zealand, followed then by, Canada as well is slightly more stringent than the United States, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Any other countries, I really couldn't say. Don't have the experience.
Now, that you also talk about shoes and clothing and fibers. And what should we be looking for if we want these things to be vegan?
Well, shoes basically look out that it's not leather. In the United States, shoes themselves don't have to be labelled according to their materials, but leather and imitation leather have to be labelled. So if something that's not leather or is partly leather, that has to be stated. So that's one way of checking it. Or just look out for brands which make vegan products. I mean, if you do an internet search for vegan shoes, you can find outlets, you can find mail order companies. That's okay.
Do you know about the glue in shoes?
Well, basically, the glue in shoes would be synthetic. There are a couple of reasons for that. Mm-hmm. One is that synthetic glues are just so cheap. And another reason is that, for instance, bone glue is actually used for stiff joints and not for flexible joints. So shoes have to be flexible, otherwise you couldn't walk well.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like walking in clogs. So I don't think the chances of there being any animal glues in there are very great at all. I would really count on them being synthetic. If you want to be sure about it, make sure the shoes are declared as vegan or animal friendly or cruelty free or whatever, something similar to that.
Well, that's good to know, because I've had people ask about glue in shoes, and you never see any mention about glue. You just, if you're lucky, you'll see it'll say man-made materials or non-leather or something like that. Mm. Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, and in terms of clothing, I mean, the fibers have to be declared. There are some cases where groups of fibers may be declared. So if you have a certain small percentage of mixed fibers, you might not necessarily know what's in there. But just look at the label. Keep an eye out for things like silk or cashmere, wool, and those are obvious. And if you're not sure, ask the shop assistant or even send a letter or an email to the manufacturer.
Right.
I mean, that's one way of heightening the awareness.
Unfortunately, today our shop assistants usually don't know very much about their products. I don't know if it's different in Europe, but
Yes, it's much like that over here. But I think that is also one way of forcing them to know. Go there, make ask uncomfortable questions, inconvenient questions, put them on the spot. They have to refer to the supervisor. The supervisor has to find it out. So in a way, you're forcing them to put in consumer-friendly infrastructure. If enough people go and pester them, they're going to have some sort of information ready.
Right, I agree. Now, what about you have some mention about painting products and bristles and brushes.
Yes.
Now, those are rarely labeled, too, because the bristles can come from animal or synthetic, right?
Well, yes, but generally you'll find in terms of, hobby and artist supplies, the synthetic fibers tend to be named, and the animal ones as well, if you look at artist supplies, because they tend to use that as a statement of quality. So if you're using sable, for instance, that's regarded as something of quality, or other animal hairs, bristles in the brushes, that's something they tend to be proud of instead of trying to hide it. So
yeah.
I actually don't think that's too much of a problem. You can count on them stating what's in it.
Okay, well, that's good to know. There are just so many different products out there. A lot of us concentrate just on food, and animals are used in just about everything. And when start to think about it, you realize.
Yes, exactly. I mean, even things like batteries, electrical appliances, metals. They use these gelatin in metalworking, or for processing cadmium in batteries. I mean, there was even an article recently about the brakes and trains having been processed with gelatin. So whenever the train slows down, it's using dead pigs. So I mean, it's something. It's if it weren't true, you'd think it's just too ridiculous to be true, but
yeah.
It is.
You know, I had thought that we had gotten to a better place with digital photography because film required gelatin and sometimes dairy products. And but then you mentioned the photo paper that we use at home to print on has gelatin in it.
Yeah, the pigments are embedded in a very thin layer of gelatin.
Yes. Oh, goodness. Well, we've got a long way to go.
Yes.
But we're moving in the right direction, and this book, Veganissimo, at least spells it out from A to Z.
Well, I hope it does make a difference.
Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best to you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, and we are going to take just a little break, and in a moment we will be back with Anjali to talk about picky eating. Be right back. Hey everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass, and we are back. Thank you for joining me today. It's April 9th, 2013, and it's such a beautiful day here in New York. I hope it's beautiful where you are. I'm a little hesitant to start the next part of the show because we're going to be talking about my favorite subject, food, and I'm feeling a little hungry. So here we go. I'm going to torture myself for a while. I'm going to bring on Anjali Shah. She's the Picky Eater. She's a food writer, health coach, and owner of The Picky Eater, a healthy food and lifestyle blog. Anjali Shah grew up a whole wheat girl, but married a white bread kind of guy. Hoping to prove that nutritious food could in fact be delicious and desirable, she taught herself how to cook and successfully transformed her husband's eating habits from a diet of frozen pizzas and Taco Bell to her healthy yet flavorful recipes made with simple, wholesome ingredients. Through her blog, The Picky Eater, Anjali shares her passion for healthy, tasty cooking. Yum! Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, it's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I think you need to take over the entire country.
Wouldn't that be nice?
You started with your husband and you figured out how to get him to eat more healthfully, and now the rest of the country awaits.
Yeah, you know, I have sort of experimented on him because he's sort of the classic, you know, fast food lover and didn't think that healthy food could ever taste good. And so once I started sort of sneaking in healthy ingredients into recipes that he loved, he came around. So I'm hoping that through my blog, the rest of the country can do the same.
Well, I love the name, The Picky Eater, because it's such a fun play on words. And I like the idea of kind of changing the feeling of what the picky eater means. It shouldn't mean someone who only likes to eat certain kinds of foods, whether they're healthy or not. It should be all of us really being selective in what we eat and choosing the best foods for us. Why shouldn't we be picky?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the traditional sort of notion of what a picky eater is, you know, the little kid who only wants ice cream for dinner. And, you know, I don't see why we can all be picky about what we put into our bodies, and just choose things that are better for us and be picky in a good way. So it is a play on words, because I would say my husband's a picky eater in the more traditional sense, and I'm a picky eater in the less traditional sense. Mm-hmm. So
Your bio says that you grew up a whole wheat girl. So you were raised in a family that believed in healthy eating?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think my parents were kind of like hippies, and you know, we always had super wholesome, healthy ingredients in our house. I didn't even know what packaged food was until I went to, you know, a friend's sleepover when I discovered, you know, like Pop-Tarts and like frozen pizzas and all kinds of delicious things that may not be the most healthy for you. So
okay, so how is it you didn't rebel against your parents?
I did for a time. Mm-hmm. When I would go to friends' houses and things, I would certainly indulge. And when I went to college, I definitely, you know, quote unquote, fell off the wagon. But eventually I realized that, you know, the way that I was raised and the type of food that we would eat at home was really the type of food that made me feel the best. And so eventually I sort of ended up coming back, you know, to what I grew up with and the food that I ate at home. And even when I was a kid, you know, I would rebel by going when I was at my friends' houses, but then when I was at home, the only choices that were available to me were healthy ones. So it made it kind of hard to do that even as a child.
You know, that's such an important thing that you just said, and people should really hear it. For parents that struggle with feeding their children well, one of the first really important steps is to not have any crap in your house, to eat healthfully and not have any other, have the wrong choices.
Yeah, exactly. I like to say that if the temptation isn't in front of you, you will be much less likely to find it. So, you know, in my house, I'll have my little treat, which is my dark chocolate-covered almonds in one of the cabinets. But in general, I keep the rest of the house pretty healthy. And so if I really, really want that chocolate chip cookie, or I really, really want that pastry, then I have to go out and buy it for myself. And then I have that one time when I get to indulge, but it's not something that happens all the time.
Right. Well, you know, I like to cook a lot, and if there's, I can make anything. So if I don't have it, I could always make it, which is kind of a scary danger. But, you know, if I want a cake or cookies, I can make it. And I don't mind cooking. A lot of people want that instant gratification. They don't want to have to make anything, so they just buy the stuff. But you write that you taught yourself how to cook. So did you not help prepare the healthy meals? Are you at home when you were younger, or did you come up with a new kind of cuisine?
Both. When I was younger, I definitely was not a helper in the kitchen. I did sort of the cleanup and the chores afterwards, but I was never involved in the actual preparing the food process. And so after I got married, I actually didn't even know how to use a can opener. I had a really embarrassing experience when I tried to make enchiladas and I could not open the can of beans. So so I was, you know, at the very, very end of the spectrum of what a novice cook would be. And, you know, eventually after eating the same meal for 2 weeks, because it was the only thing that, you know, I could make, which was like veggie burgers, not even from scratch, I realized that this was not something that could go on. And so I just started looking up recipes online and trying new things and learning how to use kitchen tools. And then I started recreating some of the recipes that I had, you know, learned at home. But then I started making my own up to satisfy sort of my husband's picky taste.
Well, you know, what you went through, except learning how to cook, all the part about growing up and not knowing how to cook or prepare healthy meals, and that's what most Americans do today. Most Americans don't know where their kitchen is. They don't know how to prepare food, and it's just a part of our culture today because food has become so inexpensive and you can get it so cheaply in fast food restaurants and even higher end restaurants, and the incentive is not there for most people to prepare their own food.
Yeah, and you know, it's really hard because I, you know, cooking can be very intimidating. Figuring out sort of what things to put together that'll actually taste good in the kitchen seems like a super overwhelming task. I remember feeling the exact same way when I first started cooking. And then you spend, you know, an hour in the kitchen and then it turns out not so great, and then you feel like you wasted all that time. So I can certainly empathize with the process and what that's like. And of course, it's so much easier to go out and just buy something from, you know, your nearest restaurant or just some sort of takeout to satisfy that because you're hungry and you want to eat. So what I like to tell people is to try to start cooking when they're not hungry. So start at like 4 or 5 when you probably aren't going to starve if your dish doesn't turn out well by 6 p.m. And do a little bit of experimentation, and along the way you'll realize that it's actually not that hard. And a lot of meals you can make in 20 minutes or less, and so, you know, that's almost as fast as it would be to drive someone to pick something up and drive back home.
No, it's faster. It's even faster to than making a phone call and calling in for delivery.
Right.
You know, it's not hard to make food.
Too.
Now, your husband went along with all of this?
Well, he sort of didn't have a choice because I took control of the grocery shopping and he hates going to the grocery store, so that was an easy win.
And, okay, this may be an obvious question, but why do you want to eat the way you eat?
You know, I guess it is an obvious question, but at the same time, you know, a lot of people want to be healthy, but, you know, also struggle with some of the treats and junkier things that,
yep,
that taste really great. So, for me, what I realized after just, you know, even just a month of eating much healthier home-cooked meals, you know, organic food, I started feeling better. I had, you know, some digestive issues in the past, and those started going away, and I just realized that what I put into my body really affected how I felt and the energy levels I had and my general happiness. So it, after, you know, realizing that, it just seemed like so much more worth it to put the effort in to eating healthy. But until you have that change, you feel like you feel fine and you don't really realize how much better you could feel.
Yeah, I like to say you don't know how good you can feel until you're eating healthfully. The thing is that in our culture here in the United States, our culture of people on the standard American diet, a very, very, very bad, unhealthy diet, most people, if they're going to turn around and change their diet, don't do it until they're in a health crisis, they're older, they've gained too much weight, they really are feeling bad. And so I'm happy to see younger people interested in health. And the motivation isn't necessarily there for younger people other than maybe wanting to really keep a slim figure, because the human body is amazing at how forgiving it is for a very long time.
That is very true.
You could be in your 20s and early 30s and really trash your body and you just keep going and it doesn't really hit you.
Right, and then when it does, it might be too late, or,
yeah,
you know, or you just may be too used to the lifestyle from you've been doing for the past 30 or some odd years, and it's really hard to make a change even if you want to. So I absolutely agree. I think starting young is the best thing that you can do, starting with kids, teaching kids how to cook, getting them in the kitchen, teaching them how to grow vegetables in their garden, getting them excited about eating healthy. You know, really makes a difference, because the way that I was raised, even though I ended up sort of deviating from the path, I naturally came back to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important to instill those values and the knowledge, actually, about food and health at a young age.
Okay, so you may or may not know this, but I am a vegan, and I promote eating all plant foods. And the power, we know that most, our greatest power, our greatest nutrients come from plant foods. And people need to be eating more plant foods, whether they choose to be vegetarian, vegan, or not. Plant foods are so, so important. And you have a lot of recipes on your site, and a lot of them are vegan.
Yeah, I'm actually vegetarian. I am totally with you about plant foods being healthier, and about them being more nutritious on a number of levels. I think, you know, there are some meats out there that have benefits, like fish, for example, in terms of the omega-3s, but
it's
in
debatable.
General, you can still
debatable.
Get that from plant foods.
We can debate that one, but I don't want to do that right now. well, you know, we hear it all the time from the media and from some doctors and nutritionists about how certain foods are healthy, and I just don't agree with a lot of what some people say, and unfortunately I don't think they know what they're talking about, but you know, some of them have credentials and that makes people think that they do. But were you raised vegetarian? Did your hippie parents raise you vegetarian?
Yeah, they did. It was interesting. My dad never ate meat. My mom would only eat chicken, turkey, and fish. So I guess she was like a white meat in the white meat group. And then my brother,
I call them the
everything.
Feathered vegetables and the scaly vegetables.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And then my brother eats everything.
Wow.
And I sort of ended up, I did eat like chicken, turkey, and fish when I was growing up, but then when I went to college, I actually went vegetarian, just because once you start hearing about sort of the treatment of animals, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, how your brother went a different way.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because he's still really health conscious, but he totally eats meat and, you know, everything that comes along with that.
Yeah. So let's, you have a really nice following on your blog, and people seem really appreciative of what you're doing. What are some of the really good responses that you've got from your recipes and your spin on food?
I think the most rewarding responses that I've gotten have been from, you know, moms trying to prepare healthy meals for their kids, or dads trying to prepare healthy meals for their kids, or for their families in general, who have, and someone in their family has maybe struggled with, you know, high blood pressure or high cholesterol or, you know, certain other issues. And they've actually been able to change their lifestyle and the way that they eat by using my recipes, because they find that my recipes actually taste good to them. And so they're able to follow, just sort of use my blog as a recipe book and follow along. And it's incredibly rewarding when I get a message from a reader who has been able to transform my life with the help of my recipes, or transform their lives with the help of my recipes. Kind of amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And that's, it's amazing because it's so simple, and it really does, we know it doesn't take much, but food can really be so powerful in two ways: what we don't put into our bodies that can be harmful, and what we do put into our bodies that can really nourish us. And there's those two things both go on. And the results are quick in terms of when we stop eating what we shouldn't be eating and when we start eating what we should be eating, the body reacts really fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's so magical.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think I read a study about when they had, you know, they basically did a test on, you know, a bunch of participants, and they had them drink soda and eat junk food for 2 weeks straight, and they measured sort of the change in their, you know, in their cholesterol levels and their glucose and everything after only 2 weeks. And they were originally just very healthy eaters, and there was an incredible spike in all of the bad things. And that was just after 2 weeks. So
right. Well,
we saw
something like that in that movie, Super Size Me, and that was a month of eating really bad foods, what happened to Morgan Spurlock.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But for some people, they can really feel the difference just in a meal or a day. And
yeah.
I just want, you know, I'm glad you're out there doing what you're doing, because we need so many people just helping people get through. I don't know what it is, but there's something that makes it difficult to move over to feeding ourselves well and wanting to feel good.
Yeah, I think there's just a lot of misinformation out there, and it can be incredibly confusing. Because, you know, you go to the grocery store and you walk down an aisle, and every box in the aisle has something like whole grains and organic and natural and all these labels that actually don't mean anything until you actually look at the nutrition label
right.
on the box.
No.
But people don't know. I mean, it's so hard. Unless you read articles and you're trained in nutrition like I am, and you, how would you know? I mean, it's so incredibly confusing. So, you know, I just think that's sort of the way this country has evolved. And if you just think about, I mean, Michael Pollan, right? Eat real food, not too much, mostly plants or something, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that what he says?
Yeah. I think he actually, I'm not sure of this, but I think he took that from Jack DeLaLanne's expression, "If man made it, don't eat it."
Oh, interesting.
But Jack DeLaLanne, he's from a long time ago, so don't expect you to know who he is.
No, I've actually heard of him. I watched a video of his in one of my training classes.
Oh, good. Yeah,
he was
very, very inspirational, and he passed a few years ago. So I was going to ask you, you said you have a background in nutrition?
Yeah, I studied, I took some classes in nutritional science at UC Berkeley when I was getting my degree in economics and business, and then I also am certified as a health coach through the Institute of Integrative Nutrition.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so it's been really great so far.
And do you plan on doing more than your blog with food?
Yeah, I mean, eventually I would like to, grow my health coaching practice and help people, volunteer at various places and just sort of help to spread the word about healthy eating, because I just don't think that there's enough resources out there that are easy to access and free, or at least very, very cheap.
Right.
So yeah, that's ultimately where I want to go or what I want to do.
I'm all for that, easy access and free.
Exactly.
No, it's a challenge because you want to provide things, and a lot of people want to provide their services, but we all have to survive and make a living, so there's that balance.
Right, exactly. I'm lucky enough to have a full-time job, so I'm able to do this as sort of a service, I'm just lucky to have both.
Yeah. So do you think you're going to have a cookbook come out at some point, anything like that?
Yeah, that's the plan, actually. I'm working on a cookbook right now with recipes, that some of the recipes from my blog that are expanded and some that aren't, to give people something a little extra.
Okay, that sounds great. I wanted to tell you, actually I want to tell everybody, so while you're here I'll tell you too, because you're in the San Francisco area, but I have a nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and we have an event in San Jose on Earth Day, not too far from San Francisco, and you can find out more about it at swingandgourmets.com. That's one G in the middle, swingandgourmets.com, but we're doing a musical cabaret about healthy food. And it's going to be really fun. It's on Earth Day, which is also my birthday.
Oh, happy early birthday.
And because I like to make eating fun. And, you know, as a vegan, I talk about all of the bad things that go on in the world, how factory farming is so cruel and is so bad for the environment, and how people really struggle with food, and so many people have illnesses. And, you know, I really don't like to focus on all of that. It's unpleasant. It's dark. And I like to talk about how healthy food can bring a good life. It can bring joy and the light. And so one of the things that we're doing is doing this show because it's fun, and maybe it'll help some people get the message about healthy eating in a different way rather than being lectured to.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
So that's coming up very soon, a couple of weeks, actually.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'll try to make it out. I mean, that's not too far from my home.
Yeah, I'd love to meet you.
Yeah.
Okay, Anjali, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. I really appreciate it, and I love what you're doing, and I'm definitely going to try some of your luscious recipes.
Thank you so much for having me, and yes, let me know how you like them.
And your husband, he sounds like a lucky guy.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Anjali Shaw.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So you can check out her blog at pickyeaterblog.com, The Picky Eater. Okay, I just wanted to remind you, as I was saying, it is 2 weeks away, the Swingin' Gourmets Happy Birthday Review. And if you do live in the Bay Area, please come. I want to meet you, and it's going to be really fun. And if you don't live in the Bay Area, but you know someone who does, spread the word. And if you can't do either of those, the Swing Gourmets will come to your town. So just send me an email at info@realmeals.org and we can talk about it. Okay? Have a very, very delicious week. Bye-bye.